So my talk, the title of my talk is The Alchemy of Wisdom, which I hope would attract some people. I'm finding it really, really interesting, this topic of wisdom. And I've really been enjoying preparing the talk, actually. But I've also noticed that people sort of started with me, you're going to give a talk about wisdom. Because apparently when you think about wisdom, you start to think about some sort of thing. So I'm not particularly, I'm interested in wisdom as a perfected quality, as like a quality of enlightenment, but I'm much more interested in wisdom as a process that's deepening and deepening as we go along. And I'll just say that I can't remember not having this interest in wisdom and wanting to kind of understand how things work. And it's actually when I was ordained in the Truvatna Buddhist order, I got this name. I received this name, Yashobodhi. My preceptor gave me this name, Yashobodhi, which means she whose awakening is beautiful, which I was really happy with that kind of explanation. But she gave another explanation for my name as well, which is, she who has the perfect wisdom or knowledge by which one becomes a Buddha. So I've always felt like the first bit of my name was a bit easier somehow, because as a process, awakening, I feel it's quite a natural process, so I don't feel I particularly got to kind of do a lot in order to achieve something, you know, by that name. It didn't. But somehow I always felt that that next bit of my name was much more of a challenge. But just preparing for this and reflecting more on this and getting interested in this topic of wisdom, I feel much more at ease with it somehow. So we're doing this in the context of the six perfections, sort of the six paramitas, and the last one is wisdom. And so it's in its perfected state, it would be enlightened wisdom, but it is a process, so we're just working on it, and it's just happening. When we're practicing, wisdom will come, wisdom will manifest itself somehow. And so I found it quite fascinating to read about wisdom and to think about wisdom and reflect upon wisdom, but I also find it slightly frustrating, because I always really want to get to the bottom of something. And there's loads and loads of things that I'm potentially interested in that I have not had time to explore. But so I've had to kind of really prune my talk and take bits out and concentrate on particular other bits. But I just felt in itself, it's interesting that the process of somehow of this talk being assembled or coming into being must be informed by some sort of wisdom, you know, at least. There must be some sort of wisdom happening in order to create any kind of talk or article or any kind of a talk about Buddhism. And I've also felt, just doing this talk or thinking about this talk, that the mind is always wanting to kind of fix things and settle things, so I've sort of had to just try to keep an open mind, at least in exploring the topic. And another thing is that I thought I really wanted this talk to be very good, and then always when I'm preparing a talk, it's nowhere as good as I want it to be. But then I was actually thinking, well, then again I'm thinking about a perfected thing, of something that is in a particular shape, or that is... but it doesn't need to be, it's just a process. So actually I thought that was really great to think about it in that kind of way. So the some of the components of this talk is I'm going to talk a bit about the embodiment of wisdom, and then a bit about some definitions of wisdom, and a bit about wisdom as a process. But then we've got the three levels of wisdom, and I got particularly interested in questioning, just the whole process of questioning, playing a part in how wisdom comes into being. And so I'm going to talk a fair bit about that too, and a bit about how to work with wisdom. And I'll be finishing trying to put it in the context of the other paramita. So just let's see how far I get in the course of this time that I'll be doing this. Let me see if I can find my first page. So I've been using some books. I've been reading a bit here and there. I've been using some books by Sangharakshita. One is called Wisdom Beyond Words, which I really like, which is about the Pranyaparamita literature. And a book called What is the Dharma? A book about Buddhist psychology, Know Your Mind, all by the same author. And then I've also been looking at Access to Insight, which is an amazing resource on the internet if you're more interested in the original writings of the Buddha, the suttas. And it's particularly stuff by a guy called Tamisaro that I found interesting. And I've also been looking at an article by a woman who's a psychologist who's also very much, her work is very much informed by Buddhism, and she's called Jean Christola. I hope I was pronounced that correctly. I'd never heard of her, but I just found it really interesting. And also I've been reflecting a lot about the nature of wisdom and trying to experience the wisdom in my body and all that kind of stuff. So let's see where I get to. So first about embodied wisdom, I think it's really important when we think about wisdom to not think about it as some sort of abstract quality, because you'll never ever be able to meet wisdom unless it's embodied by a person. So wisdom we can't find as a quality somewhere floating in the universe, but it's actually embodied, it's in a person. It's in each of us, I suppose. So that's just, I think, an important aspect in thinking about wisdom. And another thing about it is, well, I think what we've been doing in meditation just now, I thought was excellent, because that is something about the Buddha keeps stressing. There's this famous line in Buddhism, which is, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard. There is something that is so wholesome and important about just being with the body and being with this basic experience. And that wisdom and being with the basic experience, they're just totally, totally related. The one, you can't find the one without the other. So the some of us might have heard this term a bit more, some of us haven't, I suppose. It's called papancha, papancha. Mm-hmm. It's proliferation. So what we tend to do when we're feeling something is adding a lot onto it with our thoughts. So for instance, we feel a bit of an unpleasant feeling in the body and we start thinking about, oh, maybe I'll get a bit ill, I don't want to be here anymore, I want to go on a holiday, my life is awful, and how am I going to get out of here, and I'm always going to be unhappy. I mean, really, sometimes this can happen. You can just have one particular feeling in the body, or even one memory, and it can spark off a whole load of sort of, we call it proliferation. And that's got nothing to do with the basic experience. It's just what we add on and on and on and on onto experience. So the idea, eventually, is to try to stick as much as we can to this basic experience and to keep this prapancha, this proliferation, to keep that sort of, to try to prune it back somehow, to try to create space in the mind. So we don't proliferate too much, because the proliferation often leads us to a suffering. It makes us, for instance, respond to situations that are actually only in our minds. They're only actually happening in our mind. For instance, Priscilla says something to me, and I've got all these sort of thoughts about what she says, and then I respond and say something horrible to her, for instance. It's only because it's all happening in the mind. But when I look back at what she's actually said to me, if I could just stay with that, there's just really no need at all to have all these thoughts and to say something horrible. So that's sort of, that is it in a very, very simple way. So the idea is to try to see if you can experience this basic experience of body and whatever is manifesting in your experience without adding a lot on. So I found this. This is a quote from the Dhammapada. Simply talking a lot doesn't maintain the Dhamma. Whoever, although he's heard next to nothing, sees Dhamma through his body, is not heedless of Dhamma, he's one who maintains the Dhamma. I quite like that. Something about seeing the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, through the body. Another translation they've got is touching the Dhamma through the body. I really like that because it really brings us back to a very simple level of experience. And also I've been trying out to just see if I could find wisdom in the body, how that would work or how that would feel in the body. And I felt, and you might, you know, if you try it sometime, might come to similar conclusions, is that I felt it should be something like openness, and it would have like a quality of freshness to it. And it would have depth somehow, it would have a lot of depth, and it would have a sense of freedom somehow. Well, this is what I felt when I was trying to just do this inquiry about how does this feel, wisdom in the body. So anyway, so this is just a point about how important it is to try to get back to this basic level of experience, the embodiment. See if I can get to this. Yeah. Definitions of wisdom, that was my next bit. So I think I may have mentioned this already, but in trying to think about wisdom, I think it's important not to see it as a thing, but to trying to see it as something that's very fluid, and that's more like a process, maybe. We tend to think a lot in nouns, and whereas apparently everything is much more fluid if you think about it in terms of verbs or things that are moving. So I see wisdom as something that's very much a fluid kind of quality rather than something that is fixed. So some definitions here. And this is a definition by Sangharakshita, by the way. With prajna, which is another word for wisdom, one is able to sort out the qualities of the compounded from those of the uncompounded, distinguishing clearly between that which is impermanent, insubstantial, painful, and unlovely, and that which is permanent, real, blissful, and beautiful. So I'll repeat that. With prajna, one is able to sort out the qualities of the compounded from those of the uncompounded, distinguishing clearly between that which is impermanent, insubstantial, painful, and unlovely, and that which is permanent, real, blissful, and beautiful. Another definition by him is wisdom means seeing reality face to face, not thinking about it, not entertaining ideas about it, but seeing it directly and experiencing it for oneself. So something, and I think we're talking about the perfected quality of wisdom. Now, if you would really be able to see reality and things as they really are, we're talking about a quality of wisdom that is quite advanced, but somehow we sometimes get these glimpses that, or these intuitions about how things really are, and that is wisdom coming into being. And maybe, if we go back to that first definition, people might have recognized these qualities of impermanence, insubstantiality, and painfulness, which are, they're also called the three lakshanas, the three marks of existence. And if you think about experience or phenomena, and you're thinking about, and you're really contemplating on them, you could see that, well, this is all Buddhist philosophy, yeah? that they're impermanent, and that they don't have a real substance to them, and that there is a painful quality in them. I don't think I've got... I mean, it will be a very, very long talk if I would go into all this, so I just let's leave that there, and maybe come back to that later. So that is just a way of describing, a way that Buddhist philosophy is describing reality. So the three characteristics of reality is that everything that arises is impermanent and doesn't have an essence, and there's something unsatisfactory about it because it's not permanent, and because it I'll just leave that there. This is one of the definitions that I thought would be quite helpful. But I don't have time to explain it, I'm afraid, if I even understand it. So something about wisdom is that you can get more insight in how experience arises, and that experience arises in dependence on conditions. And if you look at experience in that kind of way, it's much easier to respond to whatever is happening in a wise way, that you know how to respond to a particular situation, for instance. And it's also easier if you do really would penetrate or understand how your experience or somebody else's experience arises, because there's all kinds of conditions into place. It is somehow just much more, much, much easier to stay with this basic experience of the body and not get caught up in all kinds of theories and all kinds of stories that you're telling yourself about your experience. So another addition to this definition I read out is that this wisdom, discerning between what is impermanent or permanent, insubstantial or substantial, etc., is to see what is unlovely and what is beautiful. I quite like that. So there seems to be something about this, whatever it is, this faculty of wisdom, that is not an intellectual, analytical kind of thing, but it is something that's very much connected to feeling. So it's got a very strong, warm feeling quality to it, wisdom has. So if you would see things as they really are, if you could really see how things come into being, you would respond to that in a warm and compassionate kind of way. So that's the idea. That's the idea behind that. And compassion and wisdom are sometimes called in the tradition, especially the Tibetan tradition, as the two wings of a bird. So you can't really have the one without the other. It's the one is an aspect of the other. So this beauty and metta and compassion element, that is this appreciative quality of wisdom. Okay, I think I'll leave it at that. So a bit about wisdom as a process. When I was thinking about wisdom as a process, I feel maybe an image that came to mind is it's a natural process, an organic process. So I think we set out with a particular amount of wisdom somehow, if you could say an amount, or some sort of connection to a wisdom quality, and that seems to grow if you're practicing ethics, for instance, if you're practicing meditation, this element of wisdom is going to emerge more strongly through time. And my image was one image of a tree, for instance, growing. So it's going very, very slowly. How exactly it's growing is quite a mystery. It needs particular conditions. But sometimes it's got these spurts as well, when it gets a lot of water, you know, or whether the sun comes out. And sometimes it doesn't grow very fast because of particular conditions. But the process in itself is quite organic. I wasn't thinking of, you know, the image of a flower didn't quite work because it's it passes away so quickly, doesn't it? I feel it's got quite an old quality sound to it as well, isn't it? So wisdom as a process also means to me that you cannot arrive at one answer that always holds true. So something about this fluid quality of wisdom is that it's always responding. It's responding to the particular conditions that are around you at the time. So an answer to that, or a response to the world that emerges from that, will always be different, but always will always fluctuate through your life and when your conditions shift. So I've got a definition here by this woman, Jean Kristaller, and she says, wisdom is an emergent process that occurs when habitual, generally self-protective reactions of the conditioned mind are suspended and transcended, allowing integration of more complex processing to occur. Well, actually, I think if we look back to the meditation we've just been doing downstairs, for instance, I think that is what we're trying to do, is to let go into this more basic experience. And then you probably also notice that that means that a lot of those kind of, a lot of the, what I've been calling propancha, this proliferation, is getting a bit calmer, it calms down a bit more. So it's a bit like maybe a sky with clouds, and when the clouds disappear, there's space for the sun to come through. So that's how you could see wisdom as well. So it's in your being, and when the clouds, when all the quite superficial thinking is calming down, is widening up a bit more, you've got this quality of wisdom that can manifest in your experience in various degrees. And also just being more calm and still will allow that wisdom to emerge from the depths somehow as a response to your thinking or to what's happening to you in your life. So if you think a bit about wisdom as a process, traditionally we've got these three levels of wisdom. You may have heard of them. So there's three levels of wisdom. You've got the wisdom that comes into being because you're listening to somebody giving a talk or reading a book or that kind of thing. And the second level of wisdom is the wisdom that emerges because you're reflecting on things that you've read or things that you've heard. And the third kind of, third level of wisdom is a wisdom that that arises because of your, when you're getting into a more, for instance, when you go on a retreat and you get in more space to meditate, or you go on a holiday, whatever you do, you get into the space where there's more room for you to contemplate your experience, there'll be just some sort of intuition or understanding happening on the basis of what you've been experience in your life, what you've been reading about, what you've been thinking about. It's, and that's, I feel, is really a mysterious process. That's a bit like the alchemy of wisdom, something that is happening in the depths because of you just allowing for it to emerge. And how exactly it's happened, we just really don't know. Mm-hmm. But it is a result of us hearing about, well, in this case, the Buddha's teachings, or thinking about reality, or reflecting on reality, something that we've, that has really struck us, that is really, that we're really contemplating and trying to process. I actually think that for me, I'm making this movement, I think it's something about it trickling down somehow in your energy, and I have been thinking a bit about how does that work in the body with wisdom, and I do feel the thoughts are kind of happening out here, and it, and then you got this sort of whole process of it trickling through somehow. And sometime in meditation, I remember this years ago, I was on a study retreat meditating, and I just noticed something in my energy, I don't know, something happening, something coming up, and up popped a question. It was just a question coming up. I found it ever so interesting because it really seemed like a bit like one of those bubbles coming out of the mud somehow when you stir the mud in a pool. So it just came up, and it just came up as a question. And I got really interested in questions at that time. And I do, how I see it now, is that it does somehow provide or build a bridge between that wisdom or this sort of intuition of reality and understanding and the intellectual mind. Another image I had today was about a piece of... It's actually not my image. I read about this image. It's when you've got a jigsaw puzzle, for instance, and you're just looking for that one piece, it just seems like a question comes up, and it comes up as that shape of a puzzle, of a jigsaw puzzle somehow. So you've got this particular kind of thing that's missing in your understanding, and it comes up as a particular question. And somehow, in the question, the qualities of whatever it is that's true or this kind of wisdom is already inherent somehow in the question. It kind of, the question points to reality, points to wisdom somehow. Anyway, I really got interested in all this stuff about questions, and I was googling it and trying to find literature or anything I could read about, maybe research on questions, but there's not much to be found. But I did find this whole beautiful document about questions, which was written by Bhikkhu Tanisaro. I really liked that. It's just called Skill in Questions. So he's been looking at the role of questioning in the Buddhist tradition, just the art of formulating questions, answering questions. So he's written this book about it. I've not managed to read it all, but I will. I've got it on my iPad, so it's probably going to be read at some point, hopefully. So somehow these questions, the process of question is like an opening up and making a connection to the unknown. So the way he talks about questions is that they give shape to our ignorance. I really like that, actually, to think about it in that kind of way, to give shape to our ignorance. So a lot of this, the original teachings of the Buddha, well, as original as we have them, that we call the Pali Canon, a lot of that is happening in the shape of questions and answers. It's usually the Buddha being asked a question by somebody and then him answering it. So a lot of the teachings that we've got, we've received in that kind of form. And so one of the things that I found really interesting is that he has, at some point, some advice about which questions you should ask. I find that really fascinating. So just suppose that, he says, suppose that you meet somebody who's really wise, the Buddha says, what would you ask them? What would you ask them? So this is a fragment from one of those suttas. This is the way leading to discernment. When visiting a contemplative or Brahmin, to ask, what is skillful, venerable sir? What is unskillful? What is blameworthy? What is blameless? What should be cultivated? What should not be cultivated? What, having done by me, will be for my long-term harm and suffering? Or what, having done by me, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? I especially really like that last question, because it's... I won't be the only one. You know, sometimes I do things that I'm not happy with. I'd rather not do them. But the whole thing is that if I, or anybody at that time, would be asking myself that question, it's like, is this, you know, something that will make me happier long term? Or is it something that will make me unhappier in the long term? I'll probably think a bit longer, you know, before I actually do whatever it is that I'm not happy doing. So I think that's quite interesting to use that as a tool. But he's also talking, in the Buddhist tradition, there's also a lot of talk about questions that are actually, you know, some of the questions that the Buddha didn't want to answer because he didn't find them relevant. But he, so this is Tanisara Bhikkhu talking about that. He, so that's the Buddha, focused solely on questions related strategically to the end of suffering. So that is questions that would actually help in attaining that goal. For these reasons, he classified questions as they related to this focus. according to the response strategy they deserved. And he arrived at four sorts. Those, well, let's not go there. That's, I just find it really interesting that this is when you read more about Buddhism. Well, the longer I'm studying Buddhism and hearing about Buddhist texts, the more I find it so revolutionary and simple. This whole thing about, you know, really just go back to your basic experience, you know, and all this other stuff that you might be thinking about, all these answers, all this speculation, you know, just let it go, just let it go. You know, I'm not saying I can, but it would make life much more simple and happier, I think, if we were able to do that a bit more. So there is a very famous passage in, this is in this case, it's the Chula Malyunkovada Sutta, yeah. But if I say this thing about the poisoned arrow, that's probably a bit more familiar to some of you. Yeah. I'll just read it out. It's an example of, it's an example actually of this process that I've been naming prapancha, proliferation, that we might sometimes do. So I'll just read this out. It's two paragraphs. So this guy is called Malyunkya. Malyunkaputta, if anyone were to say, I won't live the holy life under the Blessed One as long as he does not declare to me that the cosmos is eternal, or that after death the Tathagata neither exists or doesn't exist, the man would die and those things would still remain undeclared by the Tathagata. The Tathagata is another word for the Buddha. Anyway, so he's making a point about asking all these questions about, you know, how old is the universe and what's happening to the body after you die and what's going to happen with you. Do you have a soul and do we have a this and do we have a that? So, it's just as if a man were wounded with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. His friends, companions, kinsmen and relatives would provide him with a surgeon. And the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether he was dark, ruddy brown, or golden coloured, until I know his home village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a long bow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring with which I was wounded was fibre, bamboo thread, sinew, hemp or bark, until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was wild or cultivated, until I know whether the feathers of the shaft with which I was wounded were those of a vulture, a stork, a hawk, a peacock or another bird, until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was bound with the sinew of an ox, a water buffalo, a langur or a monkey. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the shaft with which I was wounded was that of a common arrow, a carved arrow, a barbed, a calf-toothed, or an oleander arrow. So this man would die and those things would still remain unknown to him. So there is this thing about, you know, asking the right questions in order to get to this area of wisdom. And so these are all kind of, I would say, in the area of questions that are a bit pointless. Let's say arrow. So that's a bit about, well, you know, I'm really interested in this stuff about the questioning, so I'll probably read a bit more about it and think a bit more about it. So another thing that I was wanting to include, and I haven't included, there was a blurb that wasn't sent out, luckily, but I promised I was also going to talk a bit about the five knowledges and the four types of knowledge. I've decided not to do that on the basis of I've read them, but I feel I haven't understood them properly. They don't do much for me. I don't resonate with them, so I can't see any point in talking about them. So that's the off. So if you were expecting them, you're not going to have them. You can read about them.
So what are these things you're not going to talk about?
The five knowledges or the four types of knowledge. Sorry about that.
What are they?
Okay, if you must know. Well, the five knowledges, you know, they're related to the five Buddhas. There are all these ways of. Do I really need? I don't want to talk about them. So.
Sorry, why are you talking about them?
Because I promised them, love. I promised them because I wrote this blurb. I promised to talk about them, but I'm not going to talk about them because I feel I don't understand them sufficiently, and I'm actually not that interested in them either.
Fine.
Oh dear, this is not going to
work, is it?
Okay. So let's just move on. So I've got this little bit about working with wisdom, and it's just ways I've been thinking about that you could try to use to invite wisdom into your experience a bit more. And I actually think this works in itself, inviting wisdom. It's something about opening up and staying really calm and waiting for something to emerge, because something will emerge from the depths. I have noticed as well that if you've got the problem and you're agitated or anxious or angry even, the solution is never going to come out of those states of mind, because they make you quite narrow-minded. So you always have to, whatever, the wisdom will come if you wait for it, if you allow for it to manifest. But it's just really no use in trying to expect a solution from those mental states. So something about just relaxing, really, just relaxing. And I also sometimes try to practice this in meetings, or meditation, or sometimes in conversation, you know. Just relax, and you're just waiting for something to emerge that is wiser or deeper somehow. That's helpful. So I feel that really works. Well, maybe you could try yourself, see what you think. So another thing that I think might be useful is that if you're in a particular situation and you don't feel you've got that sort of immediate access to a deeper space or a wiser space, that you're just imagine what a wise response might be in that situation. So that might be helpful sometimes. And I do feel that those recommended questions are quite good. You know, this thing about this thing that's happening now, will that lead to, in the bigger picture, will that lead to more happiness for me and other beings, or will it make us less happy? And obviously, I mean, traditionally, this studying the Dharma, studying the teachings of the Buddha, or thinking about them, or hearing about them, meditating, those are all ways to invite more wisdom or to create more wisdom into your experience. Yeah, so lastly, I think I was going to contextualize wisdom in the six paramitas. It's the six of those perfections, and you may remember or may not remember, but we've had five previous ones, so this is a list of six. And the first is giving, or dana. And then we had ethics, sila. And virya, energy, shanti, patience, and dhyana, meditation. So this wisdom, I think Paramananda mentioned that as well, it's like that it's sort of cyclical thing. Things start with wisdom and kind of end with wisdom. But you need, obviously, wisdom in all these, with all these particular elements, all these perfections. So you need wisdom in order to know what is ethical. So just basically, you need to be able to understand that actions have consequences. And so if you do a particular thing, that will lead to more suffering, for instance, or you do a particular other thing, and it will somehow make things a bit open and spacious and positive. You definitely need that element of wisdom to come in any kind of ethical practice. But also it works the other way as well. If you do manage to, for instance, make a decision that will cause you to be a bit more positive somehow, maybe it's just a very simple decision like have your meals regularly, or if you're not somebody who goes to bed in time, you know, go to bed earlier or just make sure you got enough sleep, it will make a massive difference in your experience, and somehow there will be more space for that wisdom element or the quality of wisdom to emerge. If you're calmer, there's more opportunity to connect to this deeper space of wisdom, for instance. So that works basically with all of these perfections that we've talked about. Meditation is quite obvious, I would say. So if you're sitting in meditation, it's like you've got to decide what to do as well. You know, just deciding what kind of practice you're going to do has got that element of wisdom in it somehow, or lack of wisdom sometimes maybe. And it's also just looking at your experience. You're always applying this element of wisdom, interpreting your experience. You might sometimes not interpret your experience in meditation correctly, as it were, or helpfully somehow. So wisdom and just the experience of meditation just really go hand in hand. And so that's when it works with all of these six perfections. They inform each other. Yeah. So, in the whole, I do feel this process of wisdom. It's like a ripening process, maybe even wisdom. So it's working mysteriously. It's working in the background. It's like a processing happening in the background often. And I quite like this idea of if you do practice meditation, ethics, some reflection, maybe. It's your experience of your life is like spinning gold out of straw. I always really like that image. So in a mysterious way, we don't know how it's happening, but you're practicing and it turns into something that is quite beautiful and useful, some sort of a stronger connection to this quality of wisdom. So the raw material of our practice is obviously our lives and everything that's happening around us. So, that's the alchemy process of wisdom. And just let's finish with this kind of enigmatic text, but I quite liked it. It's also from the earlier writings, or the earlier texts in the Pali Canon. So, perceiving in terms of signs, beings take a stand on signs. Not fully comprehending signs, they come into the bonds of death. But fully comprehending signs, one doesn't construe a signifier. Touching liberation with the heart, the state of peace unsurpassed, consummate in terms of signs, peaceful, enjoying the peaceful state, judicious, an attainer of wisdom makes use of classifications but can't be classified. Anyway, I quite like this text, but I do, you know, probably we don't quite know exactly what it's meant. But I just, you know, some of these texts in Buddhism, they're really, really beautiful, and you kind of sense some sort of reality, some sort of wisdom in them. And, but it's still, I just find it really mysterious. So these are the ingredients, some of the ingredients for the alchemy wisdom. And I think that was me for tonight.